You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Patrick Cloutier. Patrick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me as your guest.
Patrick, we're going to be talking about this book, Raciology, The Science of the Hereditary Traits of Peoples by Vladimir Avdeyev. And I want to get into that in great detail in a moment. But before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are?
Yes, I am an American-born person. I live in the northeastern part of the country. And I studied the Russian language at Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. And after that, I transferred my records from DOI to UConn, and I earned a BA degree in the Russian language there. After graduation, I did some minor translation projects, mostly dealing with military history. And then, I think it was in the year 2010, I heard about the book Raciology. And it was a Russian language book, and they were searching for a translator to put it into the English language. So I responded to that, and I got in contact with the author. So we agreed to have the book translated into English, and it was a 22-month project. I translated everything myself, sentence by sentence, and I hope I was very meticulous about it, and I hope I was as accurate as can possibly be. So far, I haven't had any complaints about the accuracy of the translation. I was rather pleased with the project, and I learned a lot from it.
Okay, well, I have the book in front of me, Patrick. It's soft cover. It's 8.5 by 11, and it's 374 pages, and the last page is a note from you, from the translator, and
yes.
I'll leave that to the readers when they get the book to get to that last page, of course. The title is very interesting, Raciology. Is that an actual term, or was it made up for the book?
According to research done by the author, raciology is a term that came into use, if I recall correctly, either toward the end of the 19th century or the beginning of the 20th century. It was a term in scientific use, but it's still out of use, and actually the whole science was discredited, not disproven, but discredited after World War II, because through propaganda it was associated with the Nazi beliefs of the time, beliefs of the Third Reich, so the propaganda stuck. Vladimir Avdeyev does take pains to demonstrate that the German scientific community did not ascribe to any Aryan superior race theories or anything like that. For example, part of the propaganda of the Second World War was that the Nazis considered the Russians to be subhuman, and the propaganda of the Second World War, as I recall it, tried to ascribe these beliefs to the German scientific community as well. But Vladimir Avdeyev, through research of German race scientists and anthropologists, was able to find in their works that they did not consider the Russians to be any different from the Germans anthropologically. So he was able to refute that argument.
Mm-hmm.
In the view of the German race scientists, what would be considered the Nordic race, that is the blonde-haired, blue-eyed type, they originated in Scandinavia, and they considered the Russians to be members of the same family. They considered the Russian people to be anthropologically essentially identical to that Nordic race type. And for that matter, a lot of the pioneers of the science were of Russian origin. So the German race scientists, they took a lot of their knowledge. They built upon the shoulders of Russian racial theorists, such as, the gentleman's last name was Benecker. He was one of the pillars of the science. So it simply wouldn't make any sense for them to cast aspersions on ethnic Russians when a lot of their own work was built upon that of Russian scientists.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation. You read the book, and of course you translated it, and you're the author of several books yourself. What's the main message of this book?
I would say that the primary message is that, contrary to current popular belief, the races are different, and they have different abilities. But one of the things that raciology studies is the comparative achievements of the different races. It begins where anthropology leaves off. Anthropology is concerned with the measured differences, for example, in skulls, internal organs, and things like that. Raciology is interested in how these anatomical differences affect cultural achievements or group achievements, or how are they reflected? How are those differences reflected in the cultural achievements of the respective races? Essentially, Vladimir Avdeyev concludes and cites from other authors in the past that the European peoples, members of the white race, are more adept at building civilizations than some other races are.
Isn't that pretty obvious to your average person? Shouldn't it be?
It might not be obvious to the average person at the start. For For example, people that are in a Western civilization class, the history of Western civilization, they might study the history of Egypt. And some modern historians want to ascribe the glories of Egypt to Africans, black Africans. Perhaps you've heard of Hannibal of Carthage. He led a war against Rome in 218 BC. He was of Phoenician descent, but some modern revisionists prefer to cast him as black African. So there is a certain amount of revisionism which might lead a modern student of history down different roads. So the modern student of history might not realize that there are differences in historical and cultural achievements between races.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the parts of the book, Patrick, that really surprised you?
First of all, one of the things that really stood out for me was the fact that the scientific community has always been stymied by the inability to find a missing link, a transitional form from ancient humanoid or hominid fossils to modern types. And there were three or four references in the text, which to me, I'm just bearing in mind that this book is concerned with evolution of the race types, just bearing that in mind. So this is obviously not a book that would be promoting creation theory. And yet there's a few references in the text which sort of point in that direction. And the problem is, again, that they can't find the missing link. For example, one racial scientist, his name was Baron Egon von Eichstätt, and he's quoted as saying, "Racial differences sprang up just as mankind itself appeared, almost as though with the wave of a wand. From the most ancient ages to our times, no new skull forms have appeared." So going back to the fossil record, they can't find a pre-Homo sapiens type. Here's another one here. A Russian scientist, his name was V.L. Komarov. "For the rise of a new race, it is necessary that its characteristic traits should have appeared immediately in all the indivisible inhabitants of a given territory." In that passage, he's casting doubt on evolution of race traits over time. They just can't find these transitional forms. It's almost as though those few passages are suggesting they just kind of sprang up out of nowhere. And that really struck me. That was quite impressive for me. Another thing that really struck me, too, was that going back to the measured differences in anatomy, measurements of skulls and things like that. You know, when we go to high school, we go to biology class or whatever, and they've got the plastic skeleton hanging there in the classroom for people to look at, right?
Right.
So, you know, you kind of get the idea, well, this is what they all look like, right? But there are measurable differences, it turns out, between the skulls of European-type peoples, black African-type peoples, and Asian types. And as a matter of fact, I learned from reading this that forensic scientists, one of the ways they can determine if a skull belonged to a white man or someone who was not white was by resting the skull on its face. If the skull rolled over, it couldn't remain on its face. If it rolled over, it was determined that the skull belonged to a member of the white race because generally the cranium has a very prominent nose bone, which prevents it from being balanced on its face. Whereas Asian skulls and black African or what they call negroid type skulls, they don't have such a prominent nose bone, and so they can rest on the face.
Is that indicative of anything?
It's indicative of the race. In and of itself, no. It's just indicative that there's a difference.
Okay.
Another thing that I learned was that the nasal cavities are different, too. Negroid skulls tend to have larger openings for the nasal cavity than European or what is called Europoid type skulls. And Asian skulls tend not to have cheekbones or very prominent cheekbones.
Mm-hmm.
These are differences that are not just a matter of soft tissue. These go down to the bone. And these are hereditary characteristics. And the hereditary characteristics are very persistent. They don't change from one generation to the other. They're very persistent. They're passed down generation to generation to generation.
These are physical characteristics. What about mental?
As applied to groups, according to raciology, it would appear that Negroid groups are less capable of building civilizations. Apparently, they lack in the organizational skills or the cooperative skills that are necessary to build great cities and things like that. If you go through the historical record, let's say 4,000 years of written history, European societies and Asian societies, you know, they were building cities and things like that. But in Black Africa, they weren't developing to the same levels or at the same rate.
And they're still not developing, right?
Well, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But what Black Africa has today in terms of cities and things like that, it wasn't done on their own. That was brought to them by Europeans. And it required European expertise to do that.
If they're left to their own devices, without the Europeans, they are still in the same boat as they have been over the course of recorded history.
I would say that it could be argued that since the Europeans left, they've been far worse off. But that's another subject.
Right. What do you know about the author of the book? Of course, you translated his work. Have you met him? Do you know much about him?
I spoke to him on the phone a couple of times. He was in the Soviet Air Force. He was an officer in the Soviet Air Force. From what I understood by speaking with him, well, while he was in the service, would notice differences in group behavior between, for example, the Russian or Slavic types versus other types that were in the service. Is it something he noticed? He noticed differences, made him curious, and he delved into the study of anthropology and then subsequently raciology. Of course, when he was in service with the Soviet Air Force, the official scientific view of the Soviet scientific community was that there were no differences between the races. And, you know, what he saw every day told him otherwise. That was one of the things that made this an interesting project for me, was the fact that as a substitute teacher in public schools for many years, I had heard teachers telling their students that there are no differences between the races. Everybody's the same. That's apparently the new scientific mantra, or at least the new politically sanctioned scientific mantra. And to me, that was absurd. I mean, from the beginning, when you open your eyes tell you that there are differences between races, starting with skin color, hair texture, and so on. So for a teacher to stand in front of a classroom and tell students that there's no difference between the races, that's obviously not a scientific thing to say, but it makes people feel better. One thing in particular that interested me concerning the anthropological and anatomical differences between Negroid skulls and Europoid skulls was a feature called a metopic seam. Metopic seams are formed when a child is developing into adulthood. The skull is made up of separate bones, and over a period of time, they knit together. And the places where they knit together are called metopic seams. And anthropologists have been able to determine the rate of growth of skulls and when these metopic seams have come together, you know, at what age ranges they come together. One of the things they discovered was that the rhythm of growth is generally different among the races, and the sections of growth are also different. So as a rule, and when I say as a rule, this means that this accounts for most cases, not always 100%. In the European type, the part of the skull which protects that portion of the brain which governs motor skills, athletic skills, and things like that, those bones, they fuse together first. So that means that part of the brain stops growing first. But the part of the skull that protects the part of the brain which governs intellect, those bones, they fuse together last. So that means that in the European type, the portion of the brain which governs intellect and things like that, it continues growing after the portion of the brain which controls athletic functions has stopped growing. What the scientists found was that in the Negroid type, it's reversed. In the Negroid type, the portion of the brain which controls intellect, it stops growing first, usually in adolescence. Whereas the portion of the brain that controls athletic activities and things like that, it continues to grow. So consequently, and I'll keep in mind that the fusion of those skull bones, they're regulated by the brain growth. The fusion of those bones is a function of brain growth, not brain growth being a function of the fusion of the bones. So the bones in the Negroid type skull, as a rule, they fuse together last because that portion of the brain continues growing into late adolescence or early adulthood, whereas the section of the brain which governs intellect, it stops growing first.
The Negroid brain tells the bones to fuse shut in the intellect part, basically saying, hey, you're not going to be needing this to survive, but we're going to let your athletic skills continue to develop.
Right, right. When I read that section, it also explained a lot of what I saw in classrooms, because the frontal portion of the brain, not only does it control intellect, it controls social skills and things like that. So what I was seeing in classrooms day after day, day after year, and this is in high schools, the behavior of a lot of the black students had remained unchanged from 7th and 8th grade. They were still into the same pranks and nonsensical behavior in the 12th grade that they had been engaged in the 7th and 8th grade.
Wow. They can't control themselves.
Well, I don't want to say they can't control themselves. And I'd also like to say, first of all, there were a lot of fine students. Just to provide you some background, when I went to high school, I went to a black high school. I went to Booker T. Washington High School in Houston, Texas. There was a magnet school program there, so I went to the magnet program. And there were a lot of black students there. And I remember some of the black students, they had outscored me, for example, on the SAT. Even with, for example, they were given a 20-point bonus. If I recall correctly, it's in order to lift the black scorers as a group. They were sort of given a 20-point handicap there. Even taking away that 20-point handicap, there were still a number of black students that did outscore me on the SAT. So I recognize that. But a lot of things have changed today, too, between yesterday and today. When I was going to school in Texas, the principal or even a classroom teacher could paddle a student for misbehavior. I can tell you that that high school was as quiet as a church. nobody was disrupting the classrooms there, neither black nor white students. Whereas today, well, there's a book out on the market now by a gentleman named Colin Flaherty. It's called Don't Make the Black Kids Angry. That's essentially the rule now. Young black kids, perhaps they are not able to articulate that they have an advantage in the classrooms in regards to discipline and things like that versus the teacher, yet they're aware of it and they exercise it.
Right.
Going back to the subject of the book, Raciology, and that particular section where they're talking about cranial development, and where they're saying that the portion of the brain that governs intellect and social behavior and things like that, where they said that this stops developing first, that told me or explained to me why some of the black students were behaving the same way in the 12th grade that they were behaving, that they had behaved in 7th and 8th grade. And of course, this doesn't apply universally to all the black students, but it seemed to apply to them in greater measure than it would to the white students.
Mm-hmm.
Other things I noticed, too, was that in classrooms where, just considering the proportions of the races in the classrooms, if I was in a classroom that had, say, 90% white kids, everybody, they went to their assignment. They got to their work. It didn't require a lot of supervision. But the more you increased the proportion of black students, the less work seemed to get done. So it seemed to me that once you had fewer than, let's say, 35% white students in a given classroom population, once you had fewer than 35% white students in a classroom, work just wasn't getting done. Discipline problems just became more significant.
A lot could be said about that. Any more parts of the book that really...
The first few chapters, the chapter is titled The Blonde and Fair Race, Historiography and Anthropology. And one of the things I found to be very fascinating in that was the fact that using images of legendary heroes and things like that through time, for example, the Olympians, the Olympic gods and things like that, studying the names of ancient ruling or aristocratic families and so on. One of the things that they discovered was that the blonde-haired, blue-eyed type dominated in the ruling class or the aristocratic strata of many of the societies of the classical world, right down into the Renaissance period and even today. And this was what they would call the Nordic type. And so the theory was that, and just keep in mind, I'm not blonde-haired or blue-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
The theory was that the blonde-haired, blue-eyed type was a driving force behind the creation of the civilizations of the classical world and the post-classical world. So, for example, India, Persia, or what is today called Iran. And for the benefit of your listeners, the word Iran is actually a Persian word for the word Aryan.
Mm-hmm.
So the Iranians, they consider themselves to be the descendants of Aryans. The Nordic types, or what were then the Aryans in the distant past, they invaded Persia, they invaded Europe, and they displaced the previous ruling class. And so what you see in artwork, representations in marble, for example, of the ruling class is that they have light hair and light eyes. That's a common theme. When you go forward in time and you look at portraits of, for example, Renaissance personalities, you find the same thing. The portraits are dominated by people with light hair and light eyes. And so the theory is that in the distant past, those people who represented the ruling classes within Europe up until recent times with the light hair and light-eyed type, they were once upon a time a tribe that had invaded the rest of Europe and became the ruling class of all those societies subsequently. That was a very remarkable finding for me.
Who do you think should buy this book? Who would be interested in what this fellow has to say?
Well, I would recommend this book for anybody who has a question in their mind whenever they hear, for example, a teacher or a television personality preaching the mantra that all races are the same and that there are no differences, because obviously our senses tell us otherwise. So for anybody that wants to explore that question or do more research on the topic, this is definitely a book to read. They should be able to do so without feeling self-conscious about, for example, the title, Raciology. Somebody might say it's racist or something like that. If your eyes tell you that there's differences between the people that you observe every day, and that's the truth, those observations should be a valid subject of study without having negative associations cast upon them. I've met many people along the way. There were many black people that I knew that were very intelligent, and they were fine people, and I meet fine people of all races. I also recognize that there are differences between the white race and those races, just as they recognize differences between us and them. There should be no hindrance to recognizing the differences.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to the issue of the behavior I saw in the classrooms, too. black students that I mentioned that were, you know, involved in the same kinds of pranks and shenanigans in the 12th grade that I observed them doing in the 7th and 8th grade. That can be explained by the fact that, according to this book, the parts of their brain that control intellect and social behavior stop developing first. It can also be explained by the fact that today there's a different standard when it comes to disciplining those students. Even if they cannot articulate it, they can get away with a lot of things that, for example, white students might not be able to get away with, or Hispanic students might not be able to get away with. And as I mentioned, too, the school I went to, Booker T. Washington, they didn't tolerate nonsense from any students. And the administrators back then, in those days, they could paddle us. So that can also be another explanatory factor, is culture. But I suspect that they go hand in hand. And just keep in mind that I was a substitute teacher. I wasn't the regular staff teacher there. I would be a substitute teacher in a classroom. And so students of all kinds will try to see what they can get away with when the regular teacher's not there, when the cat's away, the mice will play. But as a rule, I found that the white students were more ready to get down to business and take care of their academic work than the black students were as a whole. So when you remove culture as a factor, then you're left with heredity. And heredity suggests that when you remove the force of discipline, that the black groups tend to fall apart first. That's what it suggests to me.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating stuff. And Patrick, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to listeners. And looking forward to talking to you again real soon.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for having me as a guest. I'll be speaking again in the future.